This episode is brought to you by our friends and sponsors Desiree and Dave from High Gravity in Tulsa. By now you know HighGravityBrew.com is the place to go to take the pain out of propane with a wide selection of electric brewing systems featuring the Warthog controllers. It's like having a brewing partner helping you that won't drink your beer. From 5 gallons to 2 barrels, whether you want a single vessel system like mine or the more traditional 2 or 3 vessels, HighGravityBrew.com has you covered. Check them out and power into 2021 at family-owned and operated HighGravityBrew.com. That's HighGravityBrew.com. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, January 28th, 2021. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, Chris Colby, author of How to Make Hard Seltzer, along with the Homebrew Recipe Bible and Methods of Modern Homebrewing, refreshes us on the basics of yeast nutrition and health. If you go to basicbrewing.com, you can find archives of our audio and video shows. If you go to basicbrewingshop.com, you can find our DVDs and our brewer's logbooks. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at basicbrewing and find our show page on Facebook as well. If you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing. And thanks to everybody who's helping out in that way. If you go to patreon.com/basicbrewing, you can see a long list of stuff that you can access if you sign up as a supporter. This Friday, I'm planning to actually post a video episode. This one's featuring a sparkling mead that I made with local honey and dry hopped with Galaxy hops. It was delicious. And financial supporters have already seen this episode along with the recipe and behind-the-scenes stuff as well. In this episode, I took advantage of, I took advantage of Steve's time to shoot 4 episodes in total in one evening. Whew! I haven't looked at the footage from the 4th one yet, but Steve did most of the talking since that was his beer, so we should be okay. I'm planning to post those out of sequence, so it should be fun to kind of track how happy I am during the shooting period of time. Let's take a look into the mailbag. Steve from DC Homebrewers in Arlington, Virginia writes in. It's a long time since we've heard from the DC Homebrewers. Great group of folks. Steve says, during your show with Garrett from the Man Made Mead channel, you both agreed that not mixing honey and water has the downside of not being able to get an original gravity measurement. However, if you know the volume of water and the volume and specific gravity of honey, can't you calculate the original gravity as the weighted average of the two, with water having a specific gravity of 1.000? From what I can find on the interwebs, the average specific gravity of honey is 1037 or so. Steve says, that wouldn't work with beer due to variables like the amount of boil-off and extract efficiency for mashing. Thanks, Steve. Good point. It must be said that the specific gravity of honey is, of course, much higher than 1037. I think that Steve is referring to the gravity potential of 1 pound of honey into 1 gallon of water. If you add 1 pound of honey into 1 gallon of water, the resulting must will be around 1037, for example. I looked it up in Designing Great Beers, and Ray Daniels lists the extract potential of 1 pound of honey into 1 gallon of water to be 1030 to 1035. So there is a range there. Apologies to metric folks, by the way. I sent Steve's note to Garrett of Man Made Mead, and Garrett says, I have a hard time saying that every honey will be the same original gravity. Some honeys have more particulates in them, especially unfiltered ones, which would theoretically take space and affect the total original gravity of a mead. I'm sure you could get very close, assuming that the specific gravity is 1037. That's 1 pound of honey into 1 gallon of water. But I do think it could be different from honey to honey. For that reason, and for the reason that not mixing honey only caused a longer fermentation and more math, well, we don't need that, had I not created an identical mead next to it, I wouldn't make it a habit to not mix my honey. It was an interesting experiment, but it doesn't hold a lot of practicality in actual mead making. If someone wanted to do a non-mixed honey mead and be 100% accurate, I would suggest to make an identical mead and stir the honey in to get a truly accurate original gravity. I appreciate that, Garrett. Yeah, I think it was a fun exercise, and I don't think Steve is suggesting that we just totally not mix the honey, but I think he has a good good point that you can get in the ballpark using that 1037 number, if that is in fact the average. Jeff from Southern New Hampshire writes with this. Jeff says, I've mailed in a couple of times asking you to give me sage advice. Good luck with that, Jeff. But this but this time I just wanted to give you a kudos. I discovered this show about 2 years ago and have never quite understood why you always wanted to make it a family show, since your target audience should be at least 18, depending on where they live, if they are making alcohol. Fast forward, and now I have a one-year-old, and I've now realized out of the dozen or so podcasts I listen to, yours is the only one that I feel comfortable playing in the car with her. Aw. So I just wanted to say thank you for having the forethought that I never did. Well, isn't that nice? Thanks, Jeff. I appreciate that. Congratulations on the fairly recent edition, by the way. You know, every now and then I hear from folks like Jeff who can listen to the podcast while, you know, taking the kids to school or on a speaker on the patio while brewing. I did read an article online the other day that said using foul language may be a sign of intelligence and could help dealing with physical pain. I can't remember the who wrote that, but there you go. Let's talk about our friends and sponsors, Ricky and Kelly from Groenfell Meadery in Vermont. Ricky says, Bright-Eyed is available for one or two more weeks. Ricky says, Bright-Eyed is a delightful, balanced combination of four of their favorite things, blueberry, iced coffee, maple syrup, and mead. Let me say that again. Blueberry, iced coffee, maple syrup, and mead. It's breakfast! In a collaboration with Runamuck Maple, Groenfell blended their blueberry mead with maple syrup-infused vanilla, cinnamon, and coffee. With the addition of complex dextrose sugar, this mead is an offbeat, flavorful drink. By the way, it's brewed in memory of Groenfell's senior brewer's stepfather, Timothy Spinale. So a portion of every sale goes to his favorite charity, Big Brothers Big Sisters. Wow. Bright-Eyed is a quaffable 5.8% ABV and is lightly carbonated. And there's good news for listeners in Kentucky. You're back on the delivery list. Apparently, there was a little snafu with FedEx's interpretation of Kentucky's alcohol laws, but now it's all good for the bluegrass state again. Groenfell is shipping to states all across this fine land. You can check out Bright-Eyed and lots of other deliciousness at family-owned and operated Groenfell.com. That's GroenFell. Okay, it's good to get back to basics every now and then, especially since that's part of the name of the show. And who better to do that with than Chris Colby? Chris Colby, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Hey, James. Thanks for having me on the show.
Welcome to 2021.
Woo! Yeah. Ugh.
No comment. We're taking a break from doom scrolling to to talk about something happier. Yeast.
Yeah.
Let's talk about some yeast. You mentioned yeast and yeast nutrition in your book on how to make hard seltzers, because it's pretty important in making hard seltzers. But it's also important in our other fermented beverages to make sure our yeast is healthy and happy and taken care of and has the nutrition and the conditions that it wants to be happy and to be fruitful and to multiply, literally. So when we get a packet of dry yeast or a packet of liquid yeast, kind of what state in the life cycle is it? I mean, is it ready to just go to work as soon as it hits some sugary liquid?
Yeah, I mean, there's two different questions there. One, like, liquid yeast, and one, dried yeast. Dried yeast is, it's been raised in a fermenter somewhere and then dehydrated, so there's no liquid in it. So, it needs to be rehydrated before you use it. And there's sort of two ways you can do that. The super easy way is just throw it in your wort and let it, it'll take in water, and in a short while that the yeast will start fermenting. And a lot of people just pitch it directly, or pitch dried yeast directly to their wort, and that basically works. And even the companies sort of recommend that you do that, just because it's possible to screw up the rehydration of dried yeast. But you can also, if you're an advanced brewer and you sort of want your yeast to be a step ahead, if you want it to be alive and actively fermenting when they hit your wort, you can rehydrate the yeast, which basically involves you got to add hot water to them, and they'll quickly expand. And in fact, you don't want to try to do this in hot wort instead of water. It's better if they've got nothing other than water to rehydrate in, because they when they're dehydrated and you add hot water to them, they take the water goes in, but anything dissolved in the water goes as well.
Now, when you say hot water, how hot is that water?
It varies by yeast strain. It's usually just right over 100, like 110, something like that, 95 for some yeast strains. It varies.
So around body
You know.
temperature, essentially.
Yeah, a little bit hotter than that generally. So it's warm water or hot water, depending on how you want to look at it. And add the hot water, and then it expands, and then you've got a hot solution of yeast. And one thing that many people sort of overlook is that you want to cool that down to at least roughly the temperature of your wort before you pitch it. And so what you should do is add small amounts of cold wort to cold wort being roughly pitching temperature, to your sample, and sort of, cool it down a little bit, stir it, let it sit 5 minutes, cool it down a little bit. And also, if it's wort, then the yeast start getting a little bit of sugar, and they're going to start, their metabolism is going to start, and then they're going to be going. And then when you pitch, that rehydrated and cooled dried yeast to your, or formerly dried yeast to your wort, that they're gonna, the yeast is up and fermenting and ready to go, and you'll get a little bit, shorter lag time, and a little bit quicker time to the peak fermentation. But again, if you want to skip all that and just have a workout, okay, you can just sprinkle dried yeast on top of the wort. And then secondarily, for liquid yeast, that's the yeast, it's been grown in a fermenter, it's flocculated out, and it's in a liquid solution, but there's not enough sugar in there for to be actively fermenting. So it's just kind of dormant. And it should have been, the whole time it should have been stored cold. So the yeast is brewer's yeast is very durable that way, at least roughly. You can store it for at least weeks, if not months, and have there be enough percentage of the yeast cells still alive to do well. And so if you can pitch liquid yeast like directly from the package into wort if you want, if you have the proper amounts, or you can make a yeast starter. And the Y yeast smack packs are sort of a mini yeast starter unto themselves, but then you can make, a slightly larger yeast starter. And for a 5 gallon batch, roughly, it's just short of 20 liters, something a 2 liter or 2 quart yeast starter, in most cases, is just about right, at least for average strength beers.
And I'll avoid making a commercial for Imperial Organic Yeast at this point because people are already they already know that I like to say that my stir plate is dusty because I don't I don't need it anymore with Imperial. Anyway, There's got to be a growth phase, right? I mean, unless you're pitching an enormous amount of yeast and a very small amount of sugary liquid, the yeast has got to grow. So it's got to have the nutrition there. It's got to have the tools to build new cells and to really do the job well.
Right. When you first pitch yeast into a wort, it needs to grow a little while, and the cells actually they physically grow a little bit, but then they bud off a daughter cell and essentially double, so they need to do that for a while, and there needs to be at least three to five doublings of the number of cells before they reach the phase where they sort of start fermenting, and that's not all, like it doesn't go, 100% growth and then stop and then 100% ferment, it sort of fades in. But, initially there's growth and a replication of the yeast cells, and then there's, fermentation started. And like I said before, that for 5 gallons of beer, which is roughly 20 liters, a 2 liter starter is a good thing. And that's that ratio of like 1/10 of the volume of what you're fermenting of a culture of yeast, that's a good pitching rate for average strength beers if you don't want to go through the hassle of counting cells and doing all that.
And what
was that? What the question was about?
Yeah, and what happens if they don't have the necessary numbers, before they start fermentation? Is that where we get like stuck fermentations and kind of sick fermentations and, nasty off flavors and such?
Yeah, there's a number of things that can happen. In terms of off flavors, you can get that. It's not necessarily because the yeast are underpitched, but because the more severely you are underpitching, the longer it takes fermentation to get going. And the that gives more times for contaminants to grow. Mm. So one thing about pitching an adequate amount of yeast is it's a component of cleaning and sanitation. It's if you pitch an adequate amount of yeast, fermentation starts quickly, and very soon, you're over about 0.5% alcohol, which is when alcohol starts killing like most everything that can otherwise live in wort. So. Yeah, you want to pitch that. And what was the question? My brain is hashed.
Well, if there's not enough cells to start a healthy fermentation, that's got to be stressful for the number of cells that are actually trying to do the work.
Yeah, it starts, and when yeast kick off most of their fermentation byproducts during the growth phase. So if you pitch only half as much as required, it's going to take one extra doubling of yeast to get to, the number of yeast that it takes to ferment. And so that there'll be that much more fermentation byproducts in your beer. And if it's, if you're a quarter of the amount, a quarter of a pitch, it's got to two doublings, an eighth, three doublings, and so forth. So you just end up with more growth out of the yeast, which then results in more of, whatever the esters and the sulfur compounds and whatever that particular yeast strain gives off, you're just going to have more of those. And that's not always a bad thing. I mean, some beers and, brewers take the yeast strain, and it has yeast characters they like, and they restrict the pitching rate a little bit. You don't want to grossly underpitch because you still need the fermentation to start quickly. And, doubly, especially if you're a commercial brewer, you can't just sit around and wait for fermentations to start forever. Mm-hmm. But, there are Belgian-y styles, Belgian-inspired styles of beer that people do restrict the pitching rate a little bit to get a little more character out of the yeast strains, because some of those Belgian adapted yeast strains give off some phenolic flavors, some peppery notes and esters and some other things that people actually like in their beer and try to increase a little bit.
So let's talk about the environment that you're pitching this yeast into. First of all, depending on the yeast strain, different yeast strains are happy at different temperatures.
Right. And like, we all know that ales ferment at a higher temperature than lagers. But like, if you just talk about yeast in general and where they're happy, both ales and lagers will ferment. Their maximum fermentation rate comes at a fairly high temperature, above what you'd ferment an ale and a lager at. It's just, you know, the yeast are happy and they're growing, but the beer they're producing would not be good. So when you make an ale or a lager, you know, you drop the temperature down to those typical fermentation temperatures, and those are still within the range that the yeast, you know, they're not unhealthy because of it, but they're growing at less than their optimal rate. And I mean, temperature has just a ton of, you know, influences on beer. It affects the growth rate, you know, the yeast double. It affects you know, which fermentation byproducts are given off. You know, the more generally that the hotter, you know, the higher the fermentation temp, the more you're going to be kicking off what, you know, the esters and whatever else that particular yeast strain produces.
And then you've got the Gewweih strains, which are perfectly happy, you know, at human body temperature. They're just they do their work quickly and they do their work cleanly. So, you know, it just all depends on how each of those different yeast strains have adapted to their environments over time.
Yeah, one thing interesting about brewer's yeast is they, you know, these aren't wild organisms that we bring in from nature and have accomplished a task. They have been living, you know, and being cultured in breweries and yeast labs from, you know, centuries. So they, you know, on the one hand, as a brewer, you want to do, you know, there are things that you want to do to make your yeast happy. But on the other hand, over the centuries, the yeast have adapted themselves to what brewers do, so that, you know, the ones that are best adapted to yeast are the ones that get, you know, repitched in the next batch, and the ones that, you know, fail at that, you know, they get washed down the brewery drain.
Mm-hmm. And if you're pitching wort for generations, you know, like these Scandinavian brewers, if you're pitching your yeast at body temperature, and you select select the yeasts that work, you know, when you do that way, then you get more yeast that work that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Let's talk about pH.
Yeah, pH.
That's the question.
Let's talk about pH.
Which reveals my knowledge about it.
I'm a history major, so I'll restrict my comments here to just beer-related stuff. But pH basically is a scale of the acidity or alkalinity or basic, by putting that, of a solution. And brewer's yeast, like almost any any organism that lives in an aqueous environment, there's a pH range that they're happy within. And then there's, additionally for brewers, there's a pH range in which the brewer's yeast performs in a way we want to. And generally, and once again, they're adapted to what we have done. Most brewer's yeast performs pretty well at or at least starts well when the pH is about 5, which is what the pH of post-boil wort is generally. Mm. Yeast strains for wine and mead work better, you know, or start to work better at a lower pH because wine must and, you know, diluted honey have a lower pH than unfermented beer wort. So, and those can go down to, you know, those are below 4, some of them as a starter. And an interesting thing about brewer's yeast is as it ferments, we all know it gets up ethanol and CO2, but one of the side chains or, you know, side metabolic activities, going on produces lactic acid, which then lowers the pH as the fermentation goes on. Now, it doesn't produce as much lactic acid as lactic acid, you know, like lactobacillus or pediococcus or any of those souring organisms. But it does produce enough that in fermenting beer, you start at a pH of about 5. And then depending on the strain, like most lagers end up like in the ballpark of 4, and most ales end up in the high 3s, somewhere in that vicinity. So it does have enough, and pH is a logarithmic scale, and so it does have the ability. It drops the acidity tenfold, which is one pH point during fermentation. Beer fermentations are interesting in that pH never really becomes a problem at the end of the fermentation. You know, it stops, and brewer's yeast is still, by the time it's flocculating out, the pH isn't bothering it. In mead fermentations, and additionally in hard seltzer fermentations, it can be a problem. If you're fermenting a mead or a hard seltzer, the pH can drop like a rock, and once it gets below 3.5, the yeast, you know, start to struggle more, and, you know, eventually they'll just quit. So as a brewer, like, you can just watch the pH drop in your, if you want to monitor pH, but it's never really going to become a problem outside of, you know, intentionally sour beer fermentations. It's never really going to become a problem for your brewer's yeast, but with mead or hard seltzer, it very much could be. Some wines too, maybe.
And so do you have to worry about what's to combat that? Do you then add chemicals basically to balance that pH more, or do you just pitch enough yeast that it gets the job done before it gets sick?
No, you add things to basically absorb the acid, like sodium or potassium bicarbonate, you know, like baking soda or the potassium version of baking soda. Potassium is better just because you end up not having so much sodium in your beverage, and also potassium, the yeast need that more than they need sodium. So, potassium bicarbonate.
Let's take a quick break from talking about yeast to talk about yeast. Imperial Organic Yeast is expanding to the East Coast, or maybe it should be called the Yeast Coast. Phase one of opening will include shipping their 4 guaranteed in-stock strains, A38 Juice, AO7 Flagship, L13 Global, and GO3 Dieter to commercial customers. Production build-out is underway, and they hope to offer their full lineup as well as homebrew pouches mid-2021, which will be here before you know it. You know we love Imperial Organic Yeast. Imperial has the highest pitch rate at 200 billion cells per easy-to-open package. My stir plate is dusty because I don't make starters anymore for moderate gravity 5-gallon batches. And if I pitch in the afternoon, my airlocks are usually bubbling before bedtime. Ask your local homebrew store about Imperial Organic Yeast and check them out at imperialyeast.com. That's imperialyeast.com. Now that we've broached the conversation about chemicals, let's talk about the chemical considerations of yeast and what they need to be healthy. In beer, I take it most of the time you don't have to worry about adding extra nutrients. That, you know, the beer word is as I take it, pretty friendly to yeast.
So, both because if you're making a wort, you know, if you've got all malt grist, you know, you're not adding just any pure sugar. There's enough nutrients, in the barley that get leached out into solution, and generally an all malt wort is going to have sufficient nutrition for an ordered fermentation. And again, you know, brewer's yeast has spent generation after generation after generation adapting to brewer's wort, so that's not a huge surprise. However, even though, you know, an all malt wort typically has the fermentational finish, sometimes adding a specific yeast nutrients can help, help reduce the lag time a little bit, can help the fermentation time go quicker, can help knock down the level of fermentation byproducts if those are higher than you want them to be. So a little, some specific yeast nutrients can help, you know, basically take an average fermentation and make it, you know, optimal. And certainly for commercial brewers who are interested in, you know, if a beer takes an extra day to ferment, that's an extra day that tank is filled up and not, you know, producing beer that makes them money. So that can be a consideration.
So let's talk about some of the chemicals. What are the chemicals that yeast need in order to be healthy and to grow and to do their job well?
Yeah, yeast have nutrients they require, and then they have micronutrients, which are just, they require them, but in less dose. And, you know, the big things, yeast need carbon, they need nitrogen, they need oxygen. Secondarily, smaller things, you know, they need phosphorus and potassium and sulfate and magnesium. And, and then there's, you know, sort of nanonutrients beyond that. They need smaller amounts. But the main thing they need, or arguably the most important thing, is they need a carbon source. They need carbon. Okay. And luckily that's never going to be a problem in brewer's wort, because that's supplied by the sugars in the wort. So, you know, maltose, maltotriose, and to a lesser extent, glucose and fructose. And so the yeast need the carbon, of course, because that gives them the energy to grow. For us, it also provides us with the byproducts, the ethanol and the CO2. And one sort of quasi-interesting thing is that, I mean, carbon is also, it's the backbone of, you know, most biomolecules, large, DNA, RNA, proteins, all that. But if you look at the chemical reaction for fermentation, you know, it's balanced. However many carbons go in, get kicked out as CO2. So you might initially think, well, you know, how is yeast getting the carbon from, you know, these sugars when it's converted completely into CO2? And the answer, of course, is that it's not completely converted into CO2. You know, the typical equation you see for fermentation is like the ideal, if every single, you know, last drop of glucose got changed into ethanol and CO2. There's side chains that some percent of the sugars get shunted off to, and those are, you know, those lead to glycogen production is one of the things. It's sugars get sort of tacked onto each other and to make a storage molecule for yeast that has an abundance of sugar at any given moment. And then it also gets shunted off into pathways where the carbon becomes sources for building other biomolecules.
So if you're fermenting a mead or a hard seltzer, or a cider, are the sugars in the solution enough to give the carbon that you need? I don't necessarily hear of people augmenting, you know, adding more carbon into a fermentation.
No, you don't need to add like coal to your fermentation or anything. It's not even the yeast.
Drop a few pencils.
Not even going to take it. Yeah, it's just the sugars are, you know, there's more carbon than the yeast needs. Or at least there's plenty. That's one thing that yeast require that does not ever need supplementation in a fermentation. I mean, you can add supplementary sugar, you know, just either glucose or fructose, and that'll boost the alcohol content. Mm-hmm. But you know, in terms of getting the fermentation to work, you never have to supplement carbon.
But nitrogen is another issue.
Nitrogen is indeed another issue. In most all grain worts, where added sugar hasn't been added. Added sugar hasn't been added. That's not the most felicitous phrase of all time. Yeah, it works without added sugar.
But you made up for it with that other $2 word that you just used. So,
yeah, there we go. Yeah, in that case, the amino acids from the proteins that were in the malt and have been broken down, that's generally enough to keep your fermentation going. Most brewer's yeast need about 250 to 300 parts per million of nitrogen to work, and that holds for wine and mead and hard seltzers too. It varies by yeast strain. Some yeast strains are more of a nitrogen hog than other, but that's 250 to 300 is sort of, you know, most yeast strains use in that ballpark. And if you're lacking in nitrogen for a yeast source, you can use DAP as a supplemental yeast nutrient. DAP is diammonium phosphate, and it basically gives up ammonium, which is nitrogen in a form, or which contains nitrogen in a form that the yeast can assimilate and take into itself. And DAP is also, a lot of brewers use what are called, or you know, what people call complete yeast nutrients, and DAP is almost always a portion of that formulation. Hmm. There may be other forms of nitrogen, including amino acids, in a complete nutrient. In a complete yeast nutrient, but generally, there's some DAP in there, and that will supply nitrogen. And in a, you know, like I said, in an all grain fermentation, wort made from an all grain grist, you're going to have enough nitrogen for the fermentation to proceed. Adding a little bit of nitrogen, especially in the form of a complete yeast nutrient where it gets some other micronutrients, may shorten your lag time a little bit, shorten the amount of time it takes to reach high Kroisen, and, you know, just overall shorten the time it takes the fermentation to progress.
And in those more complete nutrient products, you can have other things like essentially dead yeast bodies, right? I mean, you're forcing the yeast to be cannibals.
Yeah, a big portion of the formulation of yeast nutrients is what they call the yeast hulls, which are just basically the solid parts of dead yeast cells. And so, yeast cells, if they were, you know, if they're healthy and when they're grown for the intention of yeast nutrition, they are healthy. They've got all the things that yeast cells need. So yeah. You could also, in a pinch, if you were ever brewing something and you thought, I need more yeast nutrition than I have, you can make your own sort of quote unquote yeast hulls. If you just take some brewer's yeast and like boil it for a little while to kill all that, and then just add that to your wort, you know, that would supply all those nutrients.
And you can overdo it. I mean, there are certain nutrients that if you put too much in, say, you know, like if you're doing a staggered yeast nutrient, like I did with this one batch of mead, this small batch of mead, I did the staggered yeast nutrient, and I kept on adding past the time when I should have stopped. And my finished mead came with a distinctive kind of subtle urine smell. that it wasn't apparent to me until somebody told me what it was, and then I was like, oh yeah, okay. This mead smells a little like pee. So easy does it on the yeast nutrients. Plan them well, follow the recommendations, and if you're going to use the staggered yeast nutrient approach, make sure that you stop adding nutrient when the yeast don't need it anymore.
Right. The idea that a lot of people have stuck in their heads that more is better on lots of occasions is just wrong when it comes to yeast nutrients. You want yeast nutrients. You want to add enough to get the the yeast to do their job, and then you want them to be gone. You want the yeast to have taken all of them up. And there's two reasons for that. One that you discovered is they might directly have a flavor in your beer if they're left over. But secondarily, beer spoiling bacteria, you know, if you have extra nutrients left over after the fermentation, that'll give the beer spoiling bacteria something, you know, that essentially feeding them, which you don't want to do. So you want your yeast nutrients to you know, be added basically exactly the amount that you need and no more. I mean, that's problematic when you're adding a complete yeast nutrient when it's got, you know, many, many different things, and, you know, you can't vary those individual levels. But I mean, in general, you're close enough and beer is forgiving enough that if you add those in reasonable levels, you know, you won't run into problems.
And it's more important in, say, meads and hard seltzers, because there's fewer places to hide. You know, if you add extra nutrients into like a big hop bomb beer, you may not pick out the subtle aromas coming from too much yeast nutrient. But certainly, if you're doing a hard seltzer, you got to be especially careful about that.
Yeah, both meads and hard seltzers are, as a brewer, you need to pay a lot of attention to yeast nutrition. I mean, the nice thing about beer, and I mean, one of the reasons that it's a reasonably popular hop is that you generally don't have to think about it at all. You can dilute some malt extract and pitch some yeast, and it's going to turn into beer. You know, like you can mash some grains and boil it and throw some yeast in, and it's gonna brew beer. For beer brewers, nutrition is basically about shortening the lag time a little bit, speeding the overall fermentation, just altering the fermentation character, you know, a little bit to the better. In meads and hard seltzers, it's the question of, is this thing gonna ferment or not? Mm-hmm. You know, is this gonna stop halfway through? And also pH regulation in meads and hard seltzers is something that needs to be highly regulated. That in beer, beer has a lot of what chemists would call zwitter ions. They're buffers, essentially. It's amino acids are one type. And so as the pH drops during a beer fermentation, it's buffered at several points by the amino acids. And so it slows down and it never quite reaches the level where there's enough acid in the beer to start inhibiting the fermentation. But in a mead or a hard seltzer, it's just sugar and water, essentially. Or in the case of mead, there's honey is, you know, sugar and water and, you know, a tiny amount of other things. And so those are essentially, you know, completely unbuffered, or in the case of mead, very, very weakly buffered. And, you know, the pH is going to drop like a rock as it ferments, and you need to, you know, in order to have a fermentation that, you know, stops at a reasonably low final gravity and reaches that in a reasonable time, you need to manage the pH, you know, actively manage the pH, whereas in beer, it just sort of happens for you.
And we can't get out of here without talking about oxygen. And again, in beers, unless you're doing a really high gravity beer, you can just, you know, kind of shake the carboy or shake the fermenter and, you know, just get some air in there, and usually it does a pretty good job. But oxygen plays a big role in the health of yeast.
Yeah, oxygen, being able to oxygenate your wort as opposed to just doing some sort of half-assed version of aerating it.
which is what I do usually.
Yeah. Yeah, and a lot of people do, and, you know, and that's fine. But I mean, here's the thing. If you're a sort of brewer who wants to make the best beer possible, and I mean, sometimes that's me. Sometimes, yeah, I want to do do a beer and I monitor the pH all the way through and do everything right. And other times I just want to generate beer and I don't, you know, I'm not going to worry about it. But if you want to brew the best possible beer, you need to pay some attention to your oxygen. You could pitch yeast into completely unaerated wort and it would still ferment. It would just take longer and it just, you might have some fermentation byproducts that aren't, you know, particularly pleasant, and it would probably stop at a higher gravity just because the yeast never, you know, one of the things that oxygen is used for, probably the primary thing, is it makes sterols, which then get incorporated into the cell wall of the yeast. And if they don't, so if it doesn't have the oxygen, you know, it limits the number of times the yeast can bud. Although, you know, commercial yeast you buy is going to have some nutrients stacked into it, so it's got, you know, it's going to be able to go for a while on stored nutrients. But if they're not, it's not going to, you know, you're not going to generate as many cells, and the fermentation is going to be more sluggish, and you're going to end up with a sort of a sweet beer, probably with a lot of esters kicked out of it. Mm-hmm. But and that's for completely unaerated wort. And then if you use a whisk or pour you know the wort between two buckets or shake your fermenter or something, you're adding some you're getting some air entrained in the wort, and then there's oxygen in that 16% in our atmosphere, something like that.
You're the scientist.
I'm the scientist who hasn't looked that fact up in a while. that's going to help. And as with anything, you know, when you start from zero, adding things to that help you quite a bit. You know, the first little bit is going to help quite a bit for the yeast health. But then if you want to, you know, if you want to move up the ladder a little bit and get to like actual optimal, you know, brewing conditions, you should try to reach 8 to 10 parts per million of oxygen. And the simplest way to do that as a brewer is if you have one of those little sintered gas stones, mm-hmm. you know, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, the little aeration stones. You can aquariums use them too, right?
Yeah, and you can use those for pumping air into wort, and you can use those for pumping CO2 into beer. And anyway, if you use about a minute with the oxygen turned on just high enough that it's making tiny bubbles from those stones, and I like to look at the surface. You know, I like the stone to be at the bottom of my fermenter, and then I additionally swirl the fermenter a little bit so there's the yeast have to, or the bubbles have to take a rotary path to get to the top. And I like to turn it on just enough that you see the bubbles forming, but that when they reach the surface, there's almost no, you know, they're not a bunch of things popping, because that means that the oxygen has been absorbed by the wort. It hasn't reached the top. If you turn on the oxygen full blast, you're going to get large bubbles, you know, at the top, and that just means you've just sent oxygen through it, and it, you know, then it dissipates and it does you no good. So, yeah, a minute with a sintered stone and small bubbles will do it with oxygen. Or if you have an aquarium pump, you can line that. Well, either way, whether you have oxygen or an aquarium pump and using air, it's best to direct the flow through a HEPA filter before it gets to the stone. But about 8 minutes of oxygen or of air, I'm sorry, 8 minutes of air, because it's like 16% oxygen or whatever the actual value is, less than 100%, which oxygen would be, about 8 minutes of aeration that way you to your goal. I was just going to reiterate that goes the air or the oxygen from the air, or the oxygen gets incorporated into lipids, which then go to the cell wall, which allow your population of yeast to grow early on till they reach the density they need to start fermenting.
So the bottom line to all this stuff is that it's important for you to think about yeast health. when you're pitching them into your sugary substance. Beer brewers don't need to worry about it as much, but if you're making mead, and certainly if you're making a hard seltzer, look into it.
Yeah, I mean, one of the super nice things about brewing is you know, you can take like a can or two of malt extract or, you know, a few kilograms or pounds, I guess, here in America land. You know, you can dissolve malt extract, just throw some, sprinkle some dried yeast on top, and that's going to make beer. And, you know, if your cleaning and sanitation is good and your recipe is reasonable, probably actually make fairly beer. But the point for brewers studying a little bit more deeply, like the physical and chemical sort of environment that yeast brew beer best in, it helps you move sort of average fermentations to like actual good fermentations. Mm-hmm. You know, it helps, I think I've said this a couple of times now, it helps, you know, lowers the lag time and decreases the amount of time it takes you to reach the peak of fermentation. It decreases overall fermentation time, and it also decreases your final gravity. You know, the fermentation isn't going to stall out at an unacceptably high level. And, you know, I mean, you can also use it to go the other way. If you want a little more esters in your beer, you know, pitch less maybe, or aerate less, or, you know, there's, you can use all those variables that you use to get a quick fermentation to get a slightly slower, more stressed one, if that's going to produce the qualities you like, characteristics you like.
Mm-hmm. Well, excellent. This has been very, very helpful. It's good to touch on the basics every now and then, and, you know, because that's what it's all built on. You know, these are the important things that a lot of times can be taken for granted. And it's nice to touch on them again.
Yeah. You know, even for someone who, like me, I've been brewing since like 1990, just going back every once in a while, reviewing the fundamentals, I think helps it, you know, cause you can get so knee deep in details that suddenly you're starting to forget some of the basics and some of the things that, you know, are most important. And I mean, a nice thing to consider when you think about yeast nutrition is, again, that it's not the sort of thing that it's going to save like a fermentation that just can't go, you know, and make it a good fermentation. What it's going to do is move an average fermentation, and something that might struggle a bit and just not be, you know, as polished as it could be, to something that's much, much better. Much better for the yeast and much better, of course, for the brewer.
Excellent. Well, all right, Chris, I appreciate it. And again, happy and healthy and safe 2021.
Yeah. Yeah, so far, maybe 1-for-3 on that.
Well, thanks again to Chris. Be sure to check out his latest book, How to Make Hard Seltzer. And of course, his books, The Homebrew Recipe Bible, which has one of my recipes in it, and Methods of Modern Homebrewing are also excellent. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our mobile-friendly shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody who's supporting us through our Patreon page. Special goodies coming your way. Check that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer, production help for Basic Brewing Radio, and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. In the meantime, sorry, I haven't been drinking. In the meantime, stay well and stay tuned. So long.